join UnitedWeStrike.com Radio on the second Saturday of every month for our live international radio marathon. Don't buy, don't comply, ask why.
Hello, welcome to Tell the Truth. I'm Rima Ilebo, MD. I am the medical director of the Natural Solutions Foundation. Our principal website is www.drrima.truthreports.com. Now, in the wonderful world of advertising, you should never have two consonants right next to each other. That's a rule you can't break. Well, you notice that Dr. Rima Truth Reports has two consonants, two R's, D-R-R-I-M-A, truthreports.com, right next to each other, because the rules are about control. We're not about control. We're about truth, and we're also about personal freedom. Now, my guest, Jan Ervin, is a man who takes great delight in scholarship and in truth. So he's a man after my own heart. And before I introduce you to Jan, I will tell you that not long ago, within the last week, I think, Jan sent me a new article that he had written. And he said, I hope you get a chance to read this. And I think it was 46 pages long, so it was nice and chunky. And every time I started to read it, I got lifed. Something would happen, and I wasn't able to finish it. But, of course, before the show today, I made it a point to have read the entire article. I read it until 4 o'clock in the morning, and then I finished it this afternoon. And I have rarely had the opportunity to be simultaneously so entertained, so annoyed, so irritated and angry, and so informed and illuminated as I was in Jan's very, very interesting article. So I would like to introduce you to Jan, and I'd like to let you hear from him who he is and how he came to be such a passionate scholar and teller of truth at fairly deep levels. Because what we're talking about is the very construction of reality around a deception called the psychedelic movement. Very interesting. Welcome to Tell the Truth, Jan.
Rima, it's good to speak to you again, and thank you for having me on along with United We Strike.
It is a pleasure. Tell us who you are, what you do, and why you do it before we dive into the enormous deception that that you've been writing about and writing so very, very intelligently about.
Well, let's see. I guess originally I was a network engineer, and I was sick all the time in and out of the hospital for about 15 years, and I was also into studying ethnomycology and ethnobotany, which is the historical use of psychedelic plants and drugs. And being in and out of the hospital all those years, you pretty much can't keep a regular job. So you end up basically carving out your own living with, what's available. And so I began writing my first book in 2000, maybe late 2003, 2004. I published my second book, exposing that the famous Dead Sea Scrolls scholar John M. Allegro had actually told the truth and didn't make up all of his work in his book, The Sacred Mushroom of the Cross. In 2009, I, with his daughter, became the publisher of that book. And his daughter and I have worked together for a decade. And really that's actually what got me onto this path, was because for decades, there were all of these lies about John Allegro and his scholarship in his book, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, showing that in ancient Judeo-Christianity, they did use these psychoactive substances. And immediately, the world's academia just attacked him. And so beginning in 2006 or so, I began going through his book and taking all of the citations to drugs and lining them out, and then going to his footnote, putting that down, and then tracking down each and every single citation that he used. And as it turned out, except for a very few minor spelling errors and transpose numbers, every single citation checked out without exception. So then we knew that something was wrong with the entire official story, and the guy who had launched all of the attacks on John Allegro was by the, a guy by the name of R. Gordon Wasson. And Wasson was a Wall Street...
That's a name that you find in many, many diverse categories of investigation, isn't it?
Sure, right. And he was a banker, quote-unquote. He was the vice president of J.P. Morgan Bank, but he was in charge of propaganda. And I think you and I, or you and your husband, had we had all talked before in our past interviews with General Bert Stubblebine, or you, how... You know, they had basically just gone in and covered up all of the early research with Wasson and with Aldous Huxley, et cetera. But Wasson, he is the so-called discoverer of magic mushrooms. And I later discovered, with the help of Dr. Colin Ross, who's another expert in MKUltra, that Gordon Wasson was actually the head of subproject 58 for the MKUltra program. And you can actually go into the MKUltra documents and see the MKUltra subproject 58 documents there.
Jan, let me stop you. Some of our readers may not be up to speed, or not, our listeners may not be up to speed on MKUltra Project 58. One sentence for each.
Sure. All right. So MKUltra, that was basically the CIA's mind control program that blew up in Congress in the 1970s. It was all over the media. And they had been dosing with LSD and BZ and many other substances unwitting victims all over the world. They had dosed in the 1950s an entire village called Pont Saint-Esprit. And they had essentially, the official record is that they were trying to create essentially a Manchurian candidate type situation. And so all of these substances were, basically discovered by individuals. And then under MKUltra, there were 150 or so sub-projects. And one of those sub-projects was MKUltra Subproject 58, headed by a man by the name of Gordon Wasson, along with J.P. Morgan Bank and the American Philosophical Society, which was misnamed as the National Philosophical Society. But we know it was them because Wasson gave a lecture to the American Philosophical Society in 1956 during the height of his MKUltra activities. Now, Wasson is the guy who went down to Mexico, to Oaxaca, Mexico, to a town called Huautla de Jimenez, and he essentially found several shamans early on, or curanderas, healers early on. The first couple he didn't like, but eventually he found one named Maria Sabina that he used to popularize magic mushrooms, along with the help of Henry Luce, who ran Time Life.
Let me interrupt you for a moment. One of the things that I learned from your extremely interesting and well-referenced paper is that Wasson did not like one of the curanderos because he wasn't marketable. He was a one-eyed butcher who sweated a lot and smoked a big fat cigar. So they couldn't market him. They couldn't put him to use in their intended use of the psychedelic phenomena. And so they dropped him. Go ahead.
That's exactly right. And, his name was Aurelio, and they had found him in 1953, but... And he was from the same town, but he didn't, like you said, he didn't quite fit the image. And he was blind in one eye. He was a butcher. And so, the one-eyed butcher from Huautla de Jimenez doesn't quite sound as, quote-unquote, spiritual as Maria Sabina the Sabia. Now, of course, Maria is Spanish for Mary. So we see this intentional marketing tactic. They're trying to create this spiritual identity with the mushrooms. Now, interestingly, Maria Sabina herself, in her own book, she is absolutely clear that the mushrooms were never used for spiritual purposes or to find God. She is unequivocal when she says that they are for healing for the sicknesses of their people.
Now, let me back up and say that one of the very, very, very important things that your research, and this paper, of course, is just the latest episode, if you will, in long, long scholarship that you've been carrying out, one of the things that you were focusing on is the complete nonsense of the spiritual quest carried out with psychedelic drugs. That is not what psychedelic drugs ever were understood to do or be, but it was exceedingly useful to market psychedelic drugs for their purported spirituality. And I would like you to focus a bit on that, because most of us think about the propaganda that we've imbibed and really believe that psychedelic drugs do expand consciousness and bring people into some sort of state that could be experienced as communion with the essence of reality, with the divine, with God. Let's talk about that.
All right. Well, there's a whole lot there to talk about. Essentially, these substances were historically used for healing, et cetera. There's, you know, even with the Native American church and peyote use, we don't really see its rise in the United States until the 1860s. And we have to pause and think, why is that? Why was early Christianity and early Judaism using this stuff? Why were the, you know, the Mexican tribes, et cetera, using these substances? But what we see here is that while they're sold to the population as spiritual, the purpose is that they're essentially, well, we could call them suggestogens. I don't really know a better name to call them at this point. They create hypersuggestibility in the taker. And whoever the person is there watching, or whoever is the chief or the shaman or the tribe, and they can suggest whatever into the person that they want at that point. And what we see through the, and I might be missing one of your points here, but what we see through the historical record is an intentional renaming of these substances at each point when the MKUltra program was going under new aspects of research. So, for instance, early on, the first word that was created for these substances by Abram Hoffer and John Smithies, who we know were both MKUltra doctors, was a word called hallucinogen, okay? And then when it was called hallucinogen, people generally had hallucinating-type experiences. In 1957... another MKUltra researcher, and he was a very close friend. He was actually the personal doctor of MKUltra architect, which General Stubblebine and I talked about in our show. He was one of the key architects of MKUltra. That was Aldous Huxley. And Humphrey Osmond, he creates the word psychotomimetic, which means to mimic psychosis. And then what happens is later on that same year in 1957, he and Aldous Huxley are writing back and forth to each other, and they're saying, you know, about what to call these substances. What a problem. And then Aldous Huxley comes out with this word called phanerothyme, which essentially means to manifest the soul. So what we see is, first, that it's a hallucinogen, then it mimics psychosis. Now it's a soul manifester. And then in the same letters, we see Humphrey Osmond coming out with the name psychedelic. And Humphrey Osmond actually proposes certain rules that the word doesn't fall under. So what we see with the word psychedelic is it's the only word in the English language with the P-S-Y-C-H-E formation rather than O. Okay, so most words would be like psychotherapy or, you know, any other type of word regarding psycho anything. We use an O. But we have to think, why is the word psychedelic, and you know, Aldous Huxley constantly said that he didn't like it spelled that way because it should be psychedelic. But why would psychedelic be the only word that was spelled that way in the English language? And the reason why is that because they didn't want to associate these substances in any way with a psychotic or, you know, a breakdown type experience. So it had to have positive connotations to it. And then,
let me stop for a moment. I want people to understand the gravity of what Jan is telling us. This is not dry scholarship about how some neutral committee of scholars decided to name something or rename something. This is about marketing an entire cultural mind control phenomenon to take over the entire sector of thinking, questing, questioning, dissenting youth people who might be troublesome. And so the CIA...
Right. And the main target, in fact, was primarily the middle-class kids. And, in fact, they even had a term for this called pediomorphosis, or juvenilization, that was essentially coined by Arthur Koelstra or one of these earlier guys. But, you know, this is actually, they were actually, in fact, we know for a fact that the marketing was all geared towards the children and the youth countercultures. But, I mean, I don't even know if I could say it better than you just did, Rima.
Understand, this was to create a youth counterculture that wouldn't be troublesome. It would get these people inactivated. It would get them looking at their navels. It would damage their brains.
Yes.
It would make them controllable. Because make no mistake, fun it might be, but the reason that psychoactive drugs, including THC, and I know that's not politically correct to say, but that's the reality as a psychiatrist, the reason that these things, including alcohol, create states that we consider pleasurable or interesting or useful is because they are creating neurotoxicity. Now, from a legal point of view, as far as I'm concerned, if you want to make your brain toxic, if you want to make your lungs toxic, if you want to, whatever you want to do, it's your body, go ahead, have yourself a good time. But from a medical point of view, from a mind control point of view, from a psychological toxicity point of view, these are toxins, and they were used intentionally to toxify a generation and make it less of a problem.
Exactly, Rima. And, you know, I want to point out to the audience, because I know a lot of people in the audience that are hearing us right now, they're going to be very upset. Well, these substances do create spiritual experiences. I want to be clear that these substances, when you look into what the actual shamans and Kurandera, the first part of that is cure, to cure. That's a healer. That is a witch doctor, essentially. And these were people that used these substances only for curing. It, you know, Maria Sabina, throughout her work, states that they were never for spiritual purposes or for finding God. She was a very devout Catholic. Now, let me just read this quote from another MKUltra doctor, who is by the name of Dr. Louis Jolyon West. This guy was a real... you know what. But anyway, he says the role of drugs in exercise of political control is also coming under increasing discussion. Control can be through prohibition or supply. The total or even partial prohibition of drugs gives the government considerable leverage for other types of control. An example would be the selective application of drug laws permitting immediate search or no-knock entry against selected components of the population, such as members of certain minority groups or political organizations. But a government could also supply drugs to help control a population. This method, foreseen by, drumroll, Aldous Huxley in Brave New World, 1932, has the governing element employing drugs selectively to manipulate the governed in various ways. To a large extent, the numerous rural and urban communes, which provide great freedom for private drug use, where hallucinogens are widely used today, are actually subsidized by our society. And notice that even Jolyon West, and I think this was published in the late 70s, he uses the word hallucinogen there. Their perpetuation is aided by parental or other family remittances, welfare, unemployment payments, and benign neglect by the police. In fact, it may be more convenient and perhaps even more economical to keep the growing numbers of chronic drug users, especially of the hallucinogens, fairly isolated and also out of the labor market with its millions of unemployed. To society, and it's almost done here, the communards with their hallucinogenic drugs are probably less bothersome and less expensive if they are living apart than if they are engaged if they are engaging in alternative modes of expressing their alienation, such as active, organized, vigorous political protest and dissent. The hallucinogens presently comprise a moderate but significant portion of the total drug problem in Western society. The foregoing may provide a certain frame of reference against which not only the social, but also the clinical problems created by these drugs can be considered. So that really sums up the entire agenda right there. And, you know, let me read you a quote that I discovered by Marlene Dobkin de Rios, who I used to know. She was a professor of anthropology at Cal State Fullerton, and she was also an associate professor of psychiatry at UC Irvine. And she says, before she died in her book, I think this is from ayahuasca, a hallucinogenic tea laced with controversy. And she states, psychedelic substances like ayahuasca create a state of hypersuggestibility in which persons are very open to being influenced by others. Many traditional cultures have utilized this condition to inculcate cultural values and behaviors in young people as they receive initiation into adulthood. In the West, cultural values can be inculcated in the young people when using these psychedelics, especially when using them in an antinomian context, excuse me, and that word antinomian means of or relating to the view that Christians are released by grace from the obligation of observing the moral law.
Say that again, because I think people really, really need to hear this. Why would the CIA be interested in creating a state in which people felt they didn't have to follow moral law?
Well, that's essentially the whole goal is to collapse the whole society. It's, you know, throughout history, the elites, the royal families, the banking families, they've sort of caused these dark ages on and off throughout history. So they're trying to recreate a dark age right now, and they're trying to wipe out the bourgeois middle class that is essentially the most productive, does the most creating, etc. And, you know, and what the elite love to do is they love to steer us down these wrong paths, such as with combustion engines and then all of these problems, and then blame the people for their own marketing and their own push on the people. You know, they destroy Tesla research and then blame the people for, you know, energy being of a concern and all of this stuff. But, okay, so I'll read that again just so people are clear. Psychedelic substances like ayahuasca create a state of hypersuggestibility in which persons are very open to being influenced by others. Many traditional cultures have utilized this condition to inculcate cultural values and behaviors in young people as they receive initiation into adulthood. In the West, cultural values can be inculcated into young people when using psychedelics, especially when using them in an antinomian context. And again, antinomian means of or relating to the view that Christians are released by grace from the obligation of observing moral law. And so all throughout this stuff, we see them attacking morals. You know, it's all about getting the kids, essentially, the main goal is to destroy the backbone of the family, because, you know, if all the kids are socialist little hippies running around with, you know, begging for handouts from the government, who then has to use guns to go steal the money from other people, you know, then, you know, they're not going to rebel. And if the family unit is strong, and not necessarily the nuclear family like in North America, but let's say the extended family like in Mexico and South America, where you have the aunts, uncles, cousins, and everything around, if the government collapses, most of those people and those extended families aren't going to give a damn. Their cows are still going to be there, their pigs and their lambs and their goats are still going to be there, their gardens are still going to be there, and, you know, what they need to sustain and survive is still going to be there, so they're not going to care too much. But if you can get all of these hippie kids turned, you know, into good little, grubbing handout socialists, then this works in the favor of the government, who then suppresses the people further. And, of course, hippies say, oh, you know, it's all about peace and love. But, of course, none of this socialist stuff goes down without the force of a gun. And so we, you know, we see these layers here, and I'll find you another quote here. It's this is from Gordon Wasson. It says, in the late 1930s, we held a fateful meeting to decide our course of action, either to launch a systematic and massive assault on many fronts or abandon the quest entirely. And this is from Jay Stevens. He says, our appetite for simplicity has caused us to compress the chaos of the 1960s into one monolithic youth revolt. But there were two philosophies among the revolutionaries on how the world might be remade. One path, endorsed by political power and using the vantage to raise consciousness and save the world. The other path proposed an attack on the consciousness itself using a controversial and soon outlawed family of psychochemicals, the psychedelics.
Now let's talk about outlawed. One of the most interesting moments for me as I read your book, not your book, your, and I hope you will turn it into a book, Jan, as I read your new article,
paper,
was the congressional testimony of Timothy Leary. And you need to talk about Timothy Leary's motivation here and whom he was working for. But Timothy Leary went to Congress when he was asked to participate in hearings. Actually, he was instrumental, I believe, in getting those hearings to be held. And he said, oh, you have to criminalize psychedelic drugs. And you may say, well, wait a minute. He was one of the prime advocates of the use of psychedelic drugs. And then you have to say, oh, wait a minute. What's the game here? And this immediately, of course, brings to mind the game with bringing undocumented illegal children into the United States. What's the game exactly? How does this work? Please talk about the criminalization of psychedelics in the United States.
Well, you know, first off, when we if we step back and we look at countries like Holland and Spain, et cetera, I think Portugal as well, these countries, they've virtually legalized drugs, and every single year their drug consumption rates drop considerably. And the biggest thing that we noticed, for instance, in Holland many years ago was that children in Holland, the Dutch kids, they don't like cannabis. And cannabis is legal. The parents can go out to the clubs. It's in the coffee shops. They grew up not caring about it, and most of them don't use it. And so what we see is that whenever you have, you know, legalization and easy access to drugs, you know, it's, for instance, I used to live in Yugoslavia during the 90s, and in Yugoslavia, there was absolutely no alcohol controls. Kids from 8, 10 years old, whatever, could go to the market, could buy a beer. They could open it right there in front of the market, start drinking it. Nobody cared. And what happened was you rarely saw drunk kids. I saw maybe one kid drink a beer and a half once out of, you know, in Belgrade, which is a city of millions of people. And another thing that you saw was that, you know, in the United States, people aren't allowed to drink until they're 21. So in the U.S., you have this binge drinking that goes on from 21 to 25. And that was entirely gone in Yugoslavia. And you see that in other countries like Canada. They legalize alcohol at 19. So it begins at 19 and it goes to about 23. Mexico from 18 to about 22. And so you can see this pattern that wherever the drugs are controlled, you have this outbreak and this lack of responsibility for several years after they're allowed to suddenly consume this drug. The kids in the U.S., they're allowed to go to war and die, but they can't legally have a beer. It's completely ridiculous. And so when we step back and we look at this, we see that the key thing that they needed to do to create the Summer of Love in 67 was to outlaw the drugs. So what happened is Tim Leary and Arthur Klaps are on one side, and then we have Allen Ginsberg playing another role, and then Walter Boart, the famous MKUltra researcher who authored the book Operation Mind Control, he's playing another role. Now they're all there together. They're all friends. Now Walter Boart is married to Peggy Hitchcock. Peggy Hitchcock owned the Millbrook Mansion, founded IFF and the Castelia Foundation, and she funded the Grateful Dead's first album.
Wait, Jan, you have to tell people what IFF is.
Okay, IFF was the International Federation for Internal Freedom that was set up by Leary and Peggy to promote psychedelics all over the place. It was basically a CIA front that they first tried to open up down in Mexico, and then even the Mexican government ran them out. They were so pissed off at the situation. So, you know, they created and promoted this stuff. Nowhere in their testimonies do any of them state that they're friends. Nowhere in Walter Bowert's Operation Mind Control book does he ever mention that Peggy was his wife and that his own in-laws, like, you know, for instance, the infamous Billy Mellon Hitchcock of Billy Mellon Hitchcock LSD Enterprises. Well, that's the son, or, you know, one of the sons of the Mellon Bank Empire, and as well as of Gulf Oil. You know, so Peggy is his sister. So these are billionaire kids that are working with Leary and this whole group. And so they, you know, you can tell when you read all of the congressional hearings, which they even misnamed to try to, you know, get people not to find them. But, you know, I was able to find the original prints. But when you read all of their testimonies together, you can see they're each playing their role. And Leary goes in, he's just completely absurd and ridiculous. Arthur Kleps comes in with his religion of the boo-hoos, and their saint is Tim Leary. Okay. And then you have Allen Ginsberg. He goes in, he's like, yeah, you know, he's a little bit more balanced, but his testimony is still pretty off, still not very straight. And then Walter Bowert is pretty much the straight one of the group, right? Even though he says he's that outline it will cause far more problems. And then you have Senator Kennedy and Senator Dodd immediately following up. They outlaw the substances, which becomes the Narcotic Control Act of whatever of 1966. I forget the proper name of it. Let's see here. I could tell you right now. It's Narcotic Rehabilitation Act of 1966, hearings before the Special Subcommittee, 89th Congress, second session. And so...
Your thesis here is that these substances were outlawed in order to make them more desirable because they were toxic, they were incapacitating.
Absolutely. Well, let me just expand here. Okay, so in 1957, Osman and Huxley create the word psychedelic. By 1960, Tim Leary at Harvard has 40 doctors and hundreds of students under his psychedelic studies program there. And so, you know, we can see that they're all involved in this. So what they do is, you know, in 1960, essentially, when they launched that part of the program, that is when, you know, when they change the name and promote it at Harvard, that's when people start having the religious experience. And you can read Leary and Dr. Oscar Yoniger bragging about this and laughing about it and having a good old time. And just saying, yeah, you know, the whole thing was a California invention. And Oscar Yoniger says that, you know, nobody at Harvard in the 1950s had a spiritual or religious or mystical type experience. And Leary says, wonderful, they're right. You know, and it's, you can listen, you know, and it's on an online video on YouTube. Anyone can find it. It's called A Conversation on LSD from 1979. It's black and white. Watch that thing and you'll hear them admit this stuff directly. But let me just read you. You know, and Leary, he gives a very ridiculous testimony. He's back and forth all over the place. And when you read his instructions from Marshall McLuhan, the propaganda media master, you can see that this is exactly what Leary did on the floor. But let me read you a couple of excerpts from Leary here and from Senator Dodd. Senator Dodd, don't you think that the drugs need to put under control and restriction? Dr. Leary, pardon, sir? Senator Dodd, let me rephrase my question. Don't you feel that LSD should be put under some control or restriction as to its use? Dr. Leary, yes, sir. Senator Dodd, as to its sale, its possession, and its use, Dr. Leary, I definitely do. In the first place, I think that the 1965 Drug Control Act, which this committee, I understand, sponsored, is the high watermark of such legislation. And then another couple pages down, Leary continues. Dr. Leary, yes, sir, I agree completely with your bill, the 1965 Drug Control Act. I think it is, and then Senator Dodd cuts him off, the federal government and the state governments ought to control it. Dr. Leary, exactly. I am in 100% agreement with the 1965 drug control bill. Senator Kennedy of Massachusetts. So there shouldn't be, Dr. Leary, I wish the states, I might add, would follow with the wisdom of this committee and the Senate and the Congress of the United States and follow your lead with exactly that kind of legislation. Senator Kennedy of Massachusetts.
Falling all over themselves to be first in line to say, make it a criminal substance.
Well, sure. And at the same time, they say it don't make it illegal. But when you read their testimonies, it's so ridiculous and absurd that you realize that the only thing that the Congress can do based on these absurd testimonies and, this whole rehearsal thing that they did behind the scenes is to outlaw it. And so then, California, shortly after, does outlaw it. And then in 1968, it was outlawed federally. So they go to Congress, and as the University of Richmond website says, Leary was one of the many experts who testified at the 1966 subcommittee hearings, which showed both ardent support and uncompromising opposition to LSD. Just several months after the subcommittee hearings, LSD was banned in California. And then, ladies and gentlemen, after that happened was when the Summer of Love started. And then, we even have records of Leary telling Michael Hollingshead to get back to London, because the London group hadn't gotten the latest program yet about psychedelic. They were using still hallucinogen and psychotomimetic, and nobody was having spiritual experiences. So Leary gives Hollingshead marching orders to get back to London. And since the show is in the UK or in Ireland, I wanted to just throw that in there, to get back to London to make sure that the London group and the Beatles and the Rolling Stones were in on the new message, which they did indeed get.
Let's talk about music. Now, I have maintained, and by the way, I graduated from medical school in 1970. I was politically active. I was very, very involved in the anti-war movement and civil rights and so on, and I never used drugs. I thought that it was unnecessary. I always said, and it's true, I'm high all the time. I'm very enthusiastic, and I feel connected with everything I need to be connected with. Why would I poison my brain? And people said all kinds of negative things to me. Well, interesting. I also saw on the streets of New York City, the South Bronx, I saw the FBI and the CIA come in and set up the crack cocaine distribution system. And that was a political control maneuver, exactly as the British used opium in China.
Bingo.
In the Boxer Rebellion China.
Oh, you're giving it all away, Rima.
I'm so sorry. But I saw this with my own eyes. I saw the anti-revolution poisoning, because there was a revolution about to break loose in the streets of the United States. And so I saw this and I experienced it. And when I was reading your article, Jan, I was torn between absolute rage and enormous relief that this information is so clearly set forth. I had to put that in there. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but it was something I could not resist. Go ahead. I want you to talk about Aldous Huxley, the author of the blueprint for Agenda 21 and where we're going if we don't get a hold on it, and Timothy Leary and the CIA. This is no fantasy, ladies and gentlemen. This is scholarship, and it's very important.
Well, what's interesting is regarding Aldous Huxley, and Aldous Huxley and Tim Leary were close friends, but it appears, and of course it was your husband, General Stubblebine, who confirmed my research. And since I interviewed General Stubblebine in September, I've found a lot more evidence. And there's a big 1,000-page book called The Letters of Aldous Huxley that, if you read from the 1950s to the end of his life, you can see over and over and over in there that he's recommending studies, that he's discussing this whole thing. He's interacting with key people like Dr. Louis Jolyon West that we just quoted, Dr. Humphrey Osmond, Dr. Abram Hoffer. These are all people that we know from the official MKUltra records were CIA MKUltra researchers. And so basically, Aldous Huxley and it could have even happened sooner than this, but their official version of the story is that they went to Cambridge and hired Leary for the job in 1960. And they don't use the word hired, of course. They're never that blatant. But if you go through and you read what they're saying, you know, Osmond in 1960, he says, we went out to his place and Timothy was wearing his gray flannel suit and crew cut. And we had this very interesting discussion with him. And when we went, and I don't think I told you this, Timothy, and this is from that video, a conversation on LSD I just mentioned, so people can actually go and watch that and see them saying all of this. But the night we went, we both said, what a nice fellow he is. He says, he's a very nice man. And Aldous said, it's very nice to think that this is what's going to be done at Harvard. He said, it would be good for it. And I said to him, I think he's a nice fellow, too. But don't you think he's just a little bit too square? And then the room laughs. And, of course, they don't mention too square for what. And then Aldous said, you might be right, he said. But after all, isn't that what we want? Timothy, when I'm discussing the need for understanding human temperament, this is the story I tell, because I said, yeah, Aldous and I were deeply interested in the nature of human temperament. They don't say why they were interested in it. And we met someone who I think was very probably the least satisfactory description of you ever made, Timothy. I think even your greatest enemies would never make such a description. And we made it. And we were very, very concerned because we held that perhaps you were a bit too unadventurous for what they don't say. And when you put it in context and in hindsight, it's like, oh, adventurous for that. Got it. And then he says, you see what insights we had. And then Al Hubbard, the famous Captain Trips or the Johnny Appleseed of LSD, chimes in. Speaking of Timothy, well, you sure as heck contributed your part. And so, you know, and I was just reading that line above from Tim's presentation at Congress. And if I can find it here, let me just pull up this statement so that people can understand that everything that when we saw Leary in the media and in the papers, always smiling and always just Mr. Charismatic and all of this stuff, this was all a play. Now, this was all given to him by Marshall McLuhan, who actually created the tune in, turn on, drop out meme. So Leary is at lunch with Marshall McLuhan, so here's the conversation. The lunch with Marshall McLuhan at the Plaza was informative. Drury Senate hearings and courtrooms are not the platforms for your message, Tim. You call yourself a philosopher, a reformer, fine, but the key to your work is advertising. You're promoting a product, the new and improved accelerated brain. You must use the most current tactics for arousing customer interest. Associate LSD with all the good things that the brain can produce. Beauty, fun, philosophic wonder, religious revelation, increased intelligence, mystical romance. Word of mouth from satisfied customers will help, but get your rock and roll friends to write jingles about the brain, he said. Lysergic acid hits the spot, 40 billion neurons, that's a lot. The problem is tricky, I said. The opposition beat us to the punch. The psychiatrists, the police, the propagandists have already stressed the negative, which can be dangerous when the mind is re-imprinted or re-imprinting under. And so they're admitting that they're re-imprinting the brain here. And then he says, they may be deliberately provoking bad trips. They never mention the 999 good experiences. They keep repeating LSD, jump out a window. When some ill-prepared person goes spinning into new realms, he or she wonders, what happens now? Oh, yeah, jump out a window. It's like the over-solicitous mother who warned her kids not to push peanuts up their noses. And then he continues here, exactly, agreed McLuhan. That's why your advertising must stress the religious. Find the God within. Okay. Now, later, the word becomes entheogen, which is to generate God within. You get it? That's where the connection is right there. And so this is all frightfully interesting. Your competitors are naturally denouncing the brain as an instrument of the devil, priceless. Quote, to dispel your fear, you must use your public image. You are the basic product endorser. Whenever you are photographed, smile, wave reassuringly, radiate courage, never complain or appear angry. It's okay if you come off as flamboyant and eccentric. You're a professor, after all. but a confident attitude is the best advertisement. You must be known for your smile. You're going to win the war, Timothy, eventually, but you're going to lose some major battles along the way. You're not going to overthrow the Protestant ethic in a couple years.
Now that is an extraordinary quote, Jan. Extraordinary. What this says is that the CIA, which I believe is funded by taxpayer dollars in the United States.
Yeah, and their black ops.
And their black ops. The CIA decided to destroy the capacity for dissent of an entire culture, specifically ours. What does that mean? What does that mean philosophically? What does that mean to you as an individual listening to this? What does this mean to your understanding of where you've been, what you've done, what the culture is, what your rights are, what has been violated? I would suggest being very angry. I would suggest being deeply concerned and troubled by this. I certainly am. How about you, Jan? I mean, I know there's a lot more to this story, but you as a person...
Well, you know, it was highly upsetting for me. I mean, you know, as an ethnobotanist, ethnomycologist, and thankfully being an ethnomycologist or somebody who studies how the myths were created around cultures who use psychoactive substances, it's not too hard for me to turn around and look at our own culture and keep on writing ethnomycology. So thankfully it didn't totally, you know, destroy, you know, the field of study I'd invested in for 20 years. But on the other hand, there are a lot, the huge majority of other scholars in the field are extremely pissed off at me. I get, you know, your constant gang stalking online, and it's always the same group of people, you know, that are related with, you know, psychedelics like Daniel Pinchbeck or Simon Powell or Joe Rogan or, you know, these are the main guys. There's a handful of others, Graham Hancock, but these guys always... they're always going around and lying about my work. They'll always distort it. They'll never quote it or present it correctly. So, you know, and you know, I know that probably 10% of the people on my Facebook page are paid disinformants, as they've told me themselves. And so, you know, it's, you know, they're spending a whole heck of a lot of money to try and put my work down. And, you know, I spent 15 years in and out of hospitals and on the verge of death. So I don't threaten too easily, and I'm not put down very easily either.
Now, when you say these are paid disinformants, are you saying that the people that you named are also paid disinformants?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, there's you see, you know, groups of these guys, and it's always the same people. You know, and you guys, you know, General Albert, you know, he's obviously the head of intelligence. We talked about this in his interview. But these people, you know, they're following a script, so they can never stick to the facts of the conversation. It's always about ad hominem attacks, you know, all this name calling, distraction, whatever they can do. They'll never cite or quote anything in the documents. That's always the tell to me, is when somebody actually refuses to look at the work and refuses to have an intelligent point-by-point conversation about it. And, you know, that's why I like you and General Stubblebine. It's like, yeah, you know, it's former intel and all this, but you know what? Every time that I've spoken to you two, I've had a fantastic, logical conversation. I haven't been, you know, I haven't noticed anybody, either of you, trying to fool me. And we've always had these great conversations. But you can tell these paid online trolls and gang stalkers, and, you know, some of them, they've been from the White House, like Hank Alberelli. I've documented how he launched attacks on me. Some of them have been Department of Defense. Some of them have been CIA, you know, and name your alphabet soup there. But, yeah, I mean, a lot of them have been paid disinformants going around trying to subvert my work or to distract people from it and to not study it in detail.
Now, why is it important that this information remain hidden?
Well, it's important for it to remain hidden because if the public really grasps how they were misled by Aldous Huxley, how Aldous Huxley was one of the key architects behind MKUltra, guys like Timothy Leary and Terrence McKenna and Albert Hoffman, who are the big superstars of the psychedelic age these days, if they knew that all of these guys were agents and had lied to them and were essentially, you know, using them as the butt of a joke of stupid, then they might have a different view. But, you know, people are so caught up in the Stockholm syndrome and in, you know, defending their cognitive dissonance that they can't, you know, they're unwilling is a better way to put it, to often look at the evidence. You know, and the best way to tell the difference between a disinformation person and a willful idiot or someone who's been duped is the willful idiot will generally, usually, nearly always at some point entertain the citations and be willing to look at them, whereas the script reader, the one who sticks with stupid, they never will.
Jan, you are doing enormous amounts of work. Just the article that we're discussing today, and I'm so grateful that you sent it to me, I have to tell you, just that article is a huge piece of work in itself, but it's only one part of your...
It's a good thing it only took me like 2 weeks to write it, huh?
Oh, well, right. So where can people get more information? Where can they follow up on this this conversation this afternoon?
Well, I haven't released the paper yet, but what they should do is they should go to my website where you in general were on last year, which is GnosticMedia.com, GnosticMedia.com. And I recommend people read while they wait for the new article to come out, read my article, Manufacturing the Deadhead, a Product of Social Engineering, that I co-wrote with Joe Atwill, and also read my article from the year before that on Gordon Wasson.
Jan, I wanna stop you for a second. It sounded the sound broke up, and it sounded like you were saying manufacturing the dead, but you weren't. Would you repeat?
Okay,
that?
Yeah. My article last year that I released with Joe Atwill, which they can find on the front page of my website, is called "Manufacturing the Deadhead: A Product of Social Engineering." And then another article that they'll want to read along the same lines that gives earlier history as we've been expanding all of this out. They can follow the history of the research. But the one before that was R. Gordon Wasson, The Man, The Legend, The Myth, or Beginning a New History of Psychedelic Mushrooms or something to that effect. But, you know, they'll see both of those articles up there. They can go through it. I've put a whole lot of primary documentation up there that is outside of the Harvard Library Archives. Of course, since all of this research started, Harvard has locked down the Wasson Archives, and his daughter, Masha, will not let scholars in now to view the Wasson Archives at Harvard. So they've got them all locked down because all of this evidence is coming out. So, you know, obviously the best way to prove their innocence would be to just allow anyone to see the stuff. I mean, you know, filing FOIA requests with the CIA has been less frustrating than trying to get access to the Wasson Archives at Harvard.
How very, very interesting. Who's behind all this?
Well, the whole thing?
Yeah, the whole thing.
Well, I would say the key players were Gordon Wasson and Aldous Huxley, probably Humphrey Osmond and maybe Al Hubbard. And then they worked with Alan Dulles through the Century Club, you know, through the Writers Club in New York. They also worked with Henry Luce at Time Life. Henry Luce was their magazine person. What's interesting is wherever you're studying about psychedelics and what happened at this particular time and place, there's Life Magazine. There's Time Magazine. I mean, it's just incredible how often you see Henry Luce and Time Life and C.D. Jackson, the former head of psychological warfare, show up in this stuff. It's, you know, and C.D. Jackson is the one who bought the Zapruder film of the Kennedy assassination, you know, and there's a major tie-in to MKUltra and all of this stuff as well. Like Lee Harvey Oswald was close friends with George de Morenshield, who, as it turns out, was very close friends with Gordon Wasson. So, and we
now,
have...
Let me tie in here to Aldous Huxley's Brave New World and his blueprint for the Delta worker who is being created today as the high-functioning autistic or Asperger's syndrome person being created through vaccines. intentionally. Right. And if people want to know more about that, Google the phrase autism inside job, and you will come to a 3.5-hour webinar, which is available for you to access, which Jan was a participant in, talking about precisely how the Huxley model of the interchangeable, disposable, placid, docile worker is being followed today. And on Age of Autism, John Schaefer's website, they talk about with glee the fact that global corporations are now contending to have autistic workers in their workforce and how happy they are about this.
Let me read you one more quote here, and this is from Huxley's Brave New World Revisited. I think this is, it might be the beginning of the second chapter here. In the brave new world of my fantasy, eugenics and dysgenics were practiced systematically in one set of bottles. Biologically superior ova fertilized by biologically superior sperm were given the best possible prenatal treatment and were finally decanted as betas, alphas, and even alpha pluses. In another, much more numerous set of bottles, biologically inferior ova, fertilized by biologically inferior sperm, were subjected to the Bokhinovsky process, 96 identical twins out of a single egg, and treated prenatally with alcohol and other protein poisons. The creatures finally decanted were almost subhuman, but they were capable of performing unskilled work, and when properly conditioned, desentient by free and frequent access to the opposite sex, constantly distracted by gratuitous entertainment and reinforced in their good behavior patterns by daily doses of soma, could be counted on to give no trouble to their superiors.
Precisely. Now, if you think that's fantasy, folks, you haven't been paying attention.
And, you know, people should also be aware that Julian Huxley, Aldous Huxley's brother, was the head of the British Eugenics Society. They also worked with the Royal Institute. Aldous Huxley was a Fabian socialist as well, so constantly promoting socialism and communism and reliance upon the government. Aldous Huxley and these guys also worked with John Maynard Keynes, who came up with the global banking scam. And so, you know, that's the in a nutshell of this story here. But you know, there's a lot more, and there's a lot. We probably touched on maybe 5% of what the new article touches on.
Unfortunately, yes, we've reached that time now, I'm afraid.
Well, this has been a delightful conversation with Jan Irwin. I'm Rima Elebo. We are telling the truth. And I urge you to go to Jan's website and to go to mine. Jan, give your website one more time.
GnosticMedia.com, G-N-O-S-T-I-C, media.com.
And mine is D-R-R-I-M-A, truthreports.com. Thank you for joining us.
Excellent.
Thank you for having me.
Brilliant. Jan and Dr. Rima, just stay with us there for a minute. Thanks again to everybody who've been on this section of the United We Strike Radio Marathon. This is Alan from Open Your Mind Radio in Ireland. We're going to pass over to Gary now in the States. It's Saturday the 12th of July 2014. Hope you have a good radio marathon for the next few hours. A load more guests coming on. Take care. Slán leat. Take it easy from Ireland, and we'll catch you again. Bye-bye.